This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christopher Reeve, has been back in the news. Earlier this month, he announced that he can voluntarily move his index finger and has regained some movement and sensation in other parts of his body. This is basically unheard of for someone with his type of spinal injury. His 1995 horseback riding accident broke his neck just below the brainstem, which prevents his brain from sending messages to his body. Reeve and his doctors attribute his new movement to his rigorous long-term physical therapy. His results have provoked many doctors to challenge their assumptions about the limitations of spinal cord rehabilitation. Reeve has also been in the news because of his support of controversial stem cell research, which may benefit people with spinal cord injuries. In his new book, Nothing is Impossible, he reflects on his life in the years since his accident. With the help of his medical aides, Reeve went to NPR's New York Bureau so that we could record an interview. I asked him first to describe the movement and sensation that he has regained.
Well, to sum it up, I now have movement over about 20% of my body and the sensation over almost 70%. And that's up from virtually zero when I was first injured.
And the movement that you have, is a lot of that is in the water when you're not fighting gravity the way you are outside of water.
It can also be lying on a table or lying in bed. But I have the ability to move fingers, my wrists, to extend my legs and my arms. And, you know, it's we just started working to see what would happen. And there really was No limits, and who knows where it's going to go.
What are the immediate implications of this for your ability to, say, sit up or eat, breathe, speak? How has that those aspects of life changed with this new added movement?
Well, I'd like to say that it means a different wheelchair, or it means a really, you know, huge difference in the quality of my life. But the fact is, The real benefit for somebody with my level of injury, which is it's a very high, very severe injury, is that I'm healthy. I've not had to go to the hospital for more than 4.5 years. And before the exercise had really kicked in, I was suffering from blood clots, collapsed lungs, pneumonia, skin breakdowns, you name it. So it's been a real relief to stay out of the hospital and to save my insurance company all those associated costs. And one of the reasons that I've gone so public with my recovery is to encourage the insurance companies to pay for the kind of therapy that I've had.
No, I had asked you about the implications of this for daily living. What about, like, your breathing and your speaking? How much do you have to be on the ventilator now? Is speaking easier than it used to be?
Yes, speaking is easier. It's stronger. I can go for longer periods of time off the ventilator. And
are you on the ventilator now?
Oh, yes, I'm on the ventilator now. And sorry, and I'm probably a little bit hoarse today because I've been doing a lot of talking, doing interviews. So I do fatigue a little bit. But no, my endurance is much greater than it was, and I can be off the ventilator as much as 90 minutes if I want to. And the main thing is that my diaphragm is now working, and that's really huge, because without the diaphragm working, you'll never get off the ventilator. Now I have a very good chance of getting rid of the dreaded hose.
Because of your broken neck and paralysis, you really have to live in the mind. I mean, I know you're living in the body, too, and you're probably exercising more than the rest of us are in the hopes of getting more movement back. But still, I mean, you had been an incredibly physical person doing all kinds of athletics and parasailing, horseback riding, jumping. Are there things about your mind that you've been exploring or have wanted to explore since you lost the movement of your body?
Well, yes, of necessity, I've discovered things within the mind or within the spirit. I don't know exactly where it's located. That never probably would have made themselves known to me without the accident. But for example, I've survived two near-death experiences. The one when I was injured, and then the other one was because of a reaction to a drug that was given to me while I was in a rehab center. I went into anaphylactic shock. Then I ended up flatlining briefly, and I literally had an out-of-body experience. Now, in the past, I would have been very cynical about those things, but it is quite true that, I vividly remember being up on the ceiling and looking down, that my body and all the people around working on me, and thinking that I was slipping away. And fortunately, at the last second, they gave me a shot of epinephrine, and that brought me back with a crash into my body, and I stayed in this world. But I would have been very skeptical of that beforehand.
How'd you feel then about the possibility of slipping away?
It was dangerously welcome. What was happening is sort of like people describe this when you're drowning. Is that at first you fight, and then gradually you resign, and you sort of let yourself go. And I remember being on the board. As a matter of fact, apparently the last thing that I said before they brought me back is that I'm sorry, I have to go now. No, that sounds a little bit melodramatic, but people, I guess, do say things like this in those circumstances.
So the thought of dying at that moment wasn't upsetting?
It almost seemed welcome, yeah.
So why did you, do you feel like you consciously decided to live, or that it was like the drug reaction and it was going to happen regardless of your will?
Well, but what happened is I was fighting as hard as I could to breathe and struggling. I was on 100% oxygen, and still my oxygen saturation level was going down and down and down and down, and my blood pressure was probably something like 40 over 20, and then it went lower, and then I flatlined. Then I was fighting all along to stay alive and to just fight it. And then after a while, I was just willing, I just couldn't do anymore. Then I just felt, what a relief it would be, just to not have to fight so hard anymore. So I remember just kind of letting go, this sort of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened is with this epinephrine stick, suddenly I was back. And then when everything had settled down later that night and I was stabilized, I was so, so thankful that I was still here and my family was around me. And I realized that it wasn't my time to go yet. And I realized yet again just how fragile our existence is and how much love really means.
Getting back to the idea that you've been kind of forced to really live in your mind a lot. Do you have the kind of mind that ever turns against you? Do you have the kind of mind that you have to be careful of? That you have to consciously try to prevent from turning against you, or are you okay with that?
Well, oddly enough, my mind probably turned against me more before the accident than afterwards. When I was on my feet, I remember being very self-critical and particularly because I was an actor, a performer, and, was always competitive, trying to do my best. After performance some evening, I'd say, oh, that wasn't the best I could do. Or I should have been doing this, could do that better. And so I beat myself up a lot more before the accident. And then after I was injured, I had to learn some patience. I had to learn forgiveness of myself, first of all. Because, frankly, my first reaction after being injured was that I'd done the unthinkable. I'd injured not only myself, but those around me, because they would be affected. My wife, my children, it was not, my own mess, but a mess for everybody. So at first I was very guilty. And then I found that, no, my family loved me just the way I was, that we were all still together, although things would be different. And I learned a lot about finding peace and patience and about being rather than doing as the essential component of relationships. So I actually benefited in an unexpected way.
My guest is Christopher Reeve. His new memoir is called Nothing is Impossible. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Reeve is my guest. He has a new book called Nothing is Impossible, Reflections on a New Life. Neetney, you wrote, I think this was in your earlier book, Still Me, you wrote that, you know, because there was so much going wrong with your body and so much you had to pay attention to, you had to be aware of your body all the time, and you were forced to become a serious student of yourself. And, you know, it's funny about injury or disease. It can force you into a level of self-absorption and self-consciousness that you've never had before. And I guess I'm wondering about that experience for you, too, the level of self-absorption that is forced on you.
That was the thing I was striving most to get rid of. And that's one of the most satisfying aspects of my recovery. Because in the beginning, you know, when I was suffering from ulcers and blood clots, then skin breakdowns and you know, pneumonia, collapsed lungs, etc. Yes, then I had to really pay attention all the time. For example, every 30 minutes I had to make sure to shift my position in the chair, to tilt it back or tilt it forward to change the weight distribution. I used to have to go to bed at 6:30 in the evening in order to get the weight off of my, you know, rear end and lie flat. I had to be turned every 2 hours. Being forced to pay attention to your body, you know, in ways like that, you know, just to recover your health, that drove me nuts. And finally, because of the exercise that I did, because of an excellent wheelchair seat, believe it or not, the quality of the cushion that you're sitting on in a wheelchair makes tremendous difference. Because of all the exercise, now I'm at the point where basically I'm free, much more or freer from that kind of self-absorption, and that makes a tremendous difference.
What are some of the things you've been able to turn to or to rely on for pleasure? I mean, no matter how hard you're working to try to get better and regain injury, I mean, I think one has to have things that they can turn to for pleasure.
Well, the first thing I had to learn to do was to appreciate watching other people do things that I would normally do. For example, with my children, I have three. They're now 22, 18, and 10. And particularly my older kids, I was always, very, very involved with them physically, teaching them things from everything from music to sailing to riding to skiing to just doing activities together. And with my youngest son, he was only just turning 3 when I was injured, and now he's 10, and he's quite an accomplished hockey player and saxophone player, and I had to figure out, now, how am I going to be a decent parent if I can't, you know, do things with him in the way I used to? And there was a wonderful example one day when that he was trying to learn to ride his bike without the training wheels, and very frustrated because it just wasn't going well. And my wife, Dana, had been spending a lot of time the way parents usually do, going around bent over, you know, holding onto the back of the seat, which was tough on your lower back. And I decided to see if I could help, and I went out in the driveway with him, and I just talked to him, and I said, "Well, okay, now you're gonna put the right pedal in the up position and put your foot on it, and then give it a big push. Now, don't look down at your feet. And then when you're moving, bring the other foot up and don't wobble the steering wheel, the bars, the steering bar, just and look straight ahead and just go, and it'll happen. And we're going to do it on 3. And believe it or not, I counted to 3 and he did it. And then he rode around the driveway about 15 times in a row. So I thought, this is really wonderful. I found a new way.
You know, you said you had to learn how to get pleasure watching people do things that you used to be able to do yourself. I imagine that would be hard to get over the jealousy or resentment or anger over watching people do things that you can't do anymore. Even people you love, even watching your kids do
something.
Yeah,
I don't want to sound so noble either, because there's times when I just get so jealous, I have to admit. You know, I see somebody just get up out of a chair and stretch, and I go, no, you're not even thinking about what you're doing and how lucky you are to do that. So, no, I do the best I can, but I have moments where I wish just people don't take it for granted because, you know, God forbid, you know, you could slip on a wet floor and you'd be in my position in a heartbeat.
Christopher Reeve is my guest. He has a new book called Nothing is Impossible, Reflections on a New Life. You write a little bit about your father in your book. And
yes.
Something you said about your father is that he was into theater. And he was into a more kind of political activist kind of theater.
Right.
And it sounds like he expected you to go that route too. And it sounds as if your rebellion against your father was fighting for the right to be in the mainstream.
Well, I felt that I wanted to be, I didn't want to be a starving artist. I didn't want to be, you know, someone, you know, who never has, a secure roof over his head and struggling. But on the other hand, you know, I didn't want to just sell out. Then I feel, actually looking back at my career, that it's, it ranges from big commercial films like Superman
to Merchant Ivory films, yeah.
To Merchant Ivory, and The Bostonians and The Remains of the Day are two films that I'm extremely proud of, and my father was too, as a matter of fact. So I think he just didn't want me to become an action hero.
Did he put you down for accepting Superman?
No, it was very funny that actually I was doing a play off Broadway. We went out for dinner afterwards, and then he said to me, this is back in 1977, he said, so what are you doing next? And he said, and I said, well, I think I'm gonna be doing Superman. And he said, great, well, who's playing Anne? And I said, Anne? Oh, and I realized he thought I meant Shaw's man in Superman. And the female lead's name is Anne. I said, no, actually, that this is the other Superman, and the female lead is Lois Lane. And there was a dead silence at the table. And but anyway, you know, he was not at all thrilled by my going off to do this, you know, big budget, quote, cartoon. And yet, when he saw the film and saw the dignity of the film, and great actors like Gene Hackman and Marlon Brando and Terrence Stamp, he absolutely... He changed his mind. He enjoyed it as much as anybody else.
You had to pump up to play Superman. Do you think the muscles that you developed for that role ended up coming in handy after your injury? I mean, did they help you?
Well, I'd like to say that, but the Superman was 25 years ago. I mean,
right.
I mean, the discipline to pump up muscles, though, remained. In fact, I had a deal when I was... I had to transform myself from a skinny 6'4", 185-pound weakling. Not a weakling, but nevertheless, I was very, very thin, and a very unlikely candidate to play Superman. In fact, I'll never forget the reaction of the press when I was introduced at a press conference at Sardi's by the producers. I walked in the room wearing a blue blazer, a button-down shirt, khakis and loafers. I mean, I'm a preppy from Princeton, I had to say. And I'm sure the media took a look at me and said, this is unbelievable. So anyway, I had to train very, very hard. Then I had an agreement. They gave me a driver in London because, I don't know, they didn't want me driving on the left side of the road. And I said to him, look, at the end of the day, when I get finished with work, even if I say, take me home, take me to the gym anyway. So I would doze off in the back of the car, and I'd find myself at the gym. And once I was there, there was no choice but to go in and exercise. And that's what I did, 2 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Do you ever watch your old movies?
I do sometimes, you know, particularly when they come out on DVD, because, you know, on DVD they have extra footage or behind the scenes.
Right, right. Is it creepy for you to watch your movies because it's another life?
No, believe it or not, in spite of the fact that the accident was a defining moment of before and after, in the 7 years since my injury, I've learned to see my life as a continuum. And I think that's a good sign of mental health. I mean, I think it's the sign of adjustment, so that I am able to look at myself, from the past and see it as one line.
Christopher Reeve has a new memoir called Nothing is Impossible. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Christopher Reeve. He has a new memoir called Nothing is Impossible, in which he reflects on his life since the 1995 horseback riding accident that left him with a broken neck, paralyzed from the neck down. But this month he announced he had regained some movement, which he and his doctors attribute to his rigorous long-term physical therapy. You know, what you've been able to achieve in spite of your injuries is really pretty amazing. I'm wondering, in your own mind, what balance you've tried to maintain between positive thinking and believing, you know, that anything is possible, and you know, realistic thinking, knowing that in some ways everything isn't possible.
Right. Well, when I say nothing is impossible, I don't mean that pigs are going to fly, but I'm talking about inner resources that we may not know much about, but that we can draw on, and you don't need to nearly die in order to discover these resources. That we are capable of so much more than we know. We're just sometimes afraid to venture in that direction. And the book is meant to encourage people to avoid paralysis, and I don't mean literally. Try not to end up in a wheelchair. I mean, just avoid paralysis of indecision brought on by low self-esteem or by feeling that the world is an overwhelming place or that we're inadequate or that we can't reach our goals. Just let go of that negativity. Let go of feelings that we aren't enough because we are, and because we have strength, perseverance, we have all that is available to all of us. As I say, you know, you don't need to be a Superman, or you don't need to become paralyzed in order to maximize your potential. But I do think that inaction is the worst. I think that in a way, paralysis is a choice. I'm physically paralyzed, but in some ways I'm freer than ever. Then I think that the same can apply to other people.
In what way do you think you're freer than ever?
Well, because I'm free to say what I want, which I think perhaps I used to edit myself more. I was very self-critical in the past, particularly when I was younger. I was very competitive. All of those things, you know, once you've nearly died a couple of times and really faced your own mortality, you realize that's all negative. That's all the wrong way to think. So you learn tolerance, you learn understanding. I'm much less judgmental about myself and others. And that's a message that I'd want to pass on to other people. Don't beat yourself up. Don't beat up on other people, you know, and just go as far as you can in the direction of your dreams, and you can go farther than you think.
One last question. In your dreams, do you walk still, or do you have dreams now where you're in the same physical condition that you are in reality?
No, this is really fascinating. I have never had, in the 7+ years since I've been injured, I've never once had a dream in which I'm disabled. I don't know why. I think it's probably because I'm firmly convinced that I am going to walk again, but scientists have been working on a study, and the results will be published at some time, but apparently in your dreams, if you dream very actively, if you're sailing, if you're running, if you're climbing a mountain or going for a bike ride or whatever, you are firing motor neurons in your brain the same way as if you're actually doing that activity. So perhaps part of my recovery is due to the fact that even while I'm asleep, I've been exercising my body. Now I think that's pretty cool.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Well, it seems to be a scientific fact. And since scientists are having a hard time explaining why I'm getting so much physical recovery and why it began 5 years after the injury, see, the common wisdom is that whatever recovery you're going to get will happen within the first 6 months to a year, and after that you're finished. I started getting recovery sensory recovery first, but the first motor recovery, the ability to move that index finger happened 5.5 years after my injury, and apparently that's pretty much unheard of. So I think that all of that dreaming, you know, was part of the process.
How do the doctors explain the movement that you've been able to regain in the past couple of years?
The most likely explanation, they say, is that the exercise that I've been doing is causing the reawakening of dormant pathways in the nervous system. They're still intact, but they've been asleep, really, since the injury. And over time, with exercise, they've been reawakened. Another theory is that the exercise has caused some kind of regeneration that to occur, a little bit of sprouting of nerves and some form of regeneration. And scientists are now finding that the spinal cord is much more plastic than, by that I mean that it can rebound. There's more plasticity in it than they ever knew. They've also found that there are stem cells in the spinal cord. So perhaps they are working to some extent. But I think that there are now programs coming into being around the country that are called activity-dependent recovery programs. And these are programs at various rehab facilities and universities where they take patients and get them to exercise and find that recovery comes from it. For example, it's the latest approach to dealing with people with strokes. They tie down or strap down the good part of the body, then force the disabled part to work, and they're getting surprising results. So that's a whole new field of rehabilitative medicine, which is showing a lot of promise.
Well, Christopher Reeve, a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you continued success with your recovery. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Christopher Reeve's new memoir is titled Nothing is Impossible. This is Fresh Air.